Hi everyone, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Lit Radio Podcast. I'm your host for today, Thea. For this episode, I'm joined by Per Wimmer to speak about his autobiography, The Sky is No Limit, and his many adventures, including skydiving over Everest and his space training. Per Wimmer is a global financier who founded investment management companies Wimmer Financial and Wimmer Family Office. Outside of work, he is an astronaut, adventurer, and philanthropist. Per's life story is far from ordinary and very much driven by the desire to push boundaries. The first volume of his autobiography, The Sky is No Limit, covers Per's formative years, his growing fascination for adventure, travel, and space, and the growth of his career in international finance, culminating in the founding of Wimmer Financial. Thank you very much, Per, for joining us today on the Lit Radio podcast. I'm very excited to speak with you about your first autobiography, The Sky is No Limit. But before we talk more about the book and what's in it, I would like you to ask you to describe yourself for our listeners. Who is Per Wimmer?
Yeah, so my name is Per Wimmer. I'm an entrepreneur, astronaut, adventurer, philanthropist, author, and yes, I'm very excited to have finally sort of summarized my life, or at least the first part. This is volume one, where we talk a lot about the journey to where we are today, or at least part of the journey. It has been an exciting mix between adventures, business, education, etc. I've always had a deep philosophy of believing in education in a wider sense, both in terms of formal education. I've got four master degrees from four different universities, but also education in a wider sense in the university of life, having traveled to no less than 84 countries and met so many interesting people and challenges and problems and in the university of life.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And is that why you decided to write your autobiography? Because you want to educate people on the science of life?
Yeah, my hope with the autobiography is to share my story as a source of inspiration, not at least to you, to young people who hopefully will find it interesting to see how the journey has been, the various challenges, and how to overcome those challenges. So it's really meant as a source of inspiration and hopefully an exciting story. It hasn't been boring, I can tell you, having been in those interesting places. I mean, having had a job offer from the White House under the Clinton administration, having worked on Wall Street during the dot-com period, and also later in finance during the credit crunch. So the ups and downs of financial markets were certainly been an interesting journey, let alone all the adventures, having done the world's first skydive over Mount Everest and traveled Africa thin and thick, been diving with sharks in Fiji and skied at the highest skiing station in the world at 5,500 meters, and obviously now I'm set for my next big adventure, which is to go into space as a founding astronaut on Galactic. So lots of very exciting things, exciting stories, difficult challenges, which I love to share, and hopefully that can be a source of inspiration for other people when they go through similar kind of challenges, or they need to figure out, what's the next step in my life.
Yeah, having read the book, I can definitely confirm it's a very interesting, inspiring story full of the many adventures that you certainly had. But let's tell something more to our listeners about those adventures that you speak about in the book. And let's start with your early years and your early career. So could you tell our listeners about your early career just after you graduated from Harvard University?
Yes, when I graduated from Harvard, it was the late 90s. I was spoiled for choice, like many of my colleagues, because it was a good time professionally. But the two jobs that really gave me sleepless nights was one, whether I should join Goldman Sachs, the leading global investment bank on Wall Street. And bearing in mind, this was a time where Goldman was still a private company that hadn't gone public yet, although there are rumors about it, or whether I should join the White House as a non-American under the Clinton administration, which again, terribly exciting. And I was super keen to do both, to be honest. It was a big sort of decision I had to make, which one to take. In the end, whilst a job at the White House would have been fantastically exciting, I did end up joining Goldman's after 38 interviews in Boston, New York, and London. I did find it difficult to resist because I knew that in the long term, finance was what I wanted to do, and so it kind of makes sense to join arguably one of the best firms on Wall Street, learn the ropes, get the contacts effectively, and then potentially later in life set up my own shop, which I ended up doing and which I'm running today.
Oh, yeah, you definitely had two fantastic opportunities to choose from. And then later on in the book, you've got a whole chapter that's titled A Life-Changing Year. So what happened in that year and why was it life-changing for you?
Yeah, no, there's been a few life-changing years, I must say, but obviously, going through that whole period of being at Harvard was incredibly exciting, and it was really a lot of the learning came not just from the formal education at Harvard, but also came from my fellow students. So I really picked up so many great ideas, inspirations. You remember during the last year at Harvard, I was involved in so many other things because I'd already completed a year and a half worth of credit by the time the second year came around. So I set up a Scandinavian society there. I was involved in a lot of charity work. I ran workshops for my fellow colleagues so that they could be better armed when they were to recruit and do interviews with various folks. So the whole Harvard experience was certainly something that lifted things up to the next level and allowed me access to, you know, great parts of the job market subsequently.
Definitely. But then in that chapter in the book, you describe how you started your own firm. So could you tell us more about it?
Yeah. So after Goldman's and a couple of other stops, I then came to the point where the entrepreneurial endeavors and desires were getting so big that I really, it was time to sort of draw the line and stop talking about it, but getting on with it. And on October 4th, 2007, I set up my own company, my first own company, Wingman Financial, as a boutique investment bank, and really sort of rolled the dice, cut the umbrella cord, and therefore I was finally on my own. I remember after the first month, it was really strange to see that there was not a salary check that showed up at the end of the month, like had been the case since I started working. But after that, I never looked back. I just got on with it, tried to generate some revenues. And obviously, it was in the face of what turned out to be historic times in the global financial markets, because 2007, 2008, we had this big financial crisis that was sort of emerging. Bear Stearns got bought up by JP Morgan in the spring of 2008. And obviously, September 2008, famously Lehman Brothers, one of the big investment banks in the world, went bust. Merrill Lynch, one of the top investment banks in the world, got bought out by Bank of America on the Monday. And on the Tuesday, AIG, the biggest American insurance company, got bailed out by $75 billion from the American government. Otherwise, they would have been in trouble or gone bust as well. So these were super exciting times. So I guess as an entrepreneur, I landed in the middle of all that and certainly taught me a lot of things, how to keep the ship afloat and also keep costs down, which is super important in that context. But what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I do remember specifically that week where Lehman went bust and Merrill got bought out. because that was on the Monday. And on the Saturday, I was due to fly to Nepal because I had my big historic adventure to skydive Mount Everest totally lined up. So you can imagine what a week that was. In the beginning of the week, I was going to cancel Everest. But towards the end of the week, I figured, actually, there's probably not been a better time to do such an adventure because the financial market is going to be dead for a while, which turned out to be true.
Well, that was a very exciting week for sure. But apart from the many professional successes that you share in the book, you also speak a lot about your space training and your upcoming flight into space. But how did you get so passionate about space travel?
I have a deeper and inner desire to learn, whether it's through the formal educational system or whether it's out there in the university of life. So I've always been in and out doing adventures whenever it's been possible, either between educational institutions or jobs. So whenever I've been able to find, a few months in the calendar, always try to get out there and try to learn from these adventures. So adventures are things that drive me, but fundamentally it's because of the desire to learn in a broader sense, learn how to overcome challenges, learn how to meet new people, new cultures, etc. And that's what I've done, and that drives me. And the ultimate adventure, arguably, is going to space. The Earth is kind of discovered, mostly. And having visited 84 countries, I feel that I've covered a good part of the Earth. Still more to come, of course. But less than 600 people have ever been into space. So arguably, space is the 21st century new frontier for adventurers. And I'm delighted to be one of the early birds in going there. In fact, I was one of the very first Europeans to sign up for private space. And I was also on the launch pad literally 10 minutes before the very first private person went into space, Dennis Tito, back in 2001. So I've been involved in the private space arena since the early days. And space is a big passion of mine because it is the ultimate frontier. It is where we as human beings, having traveled all over the Earth, that's where we need to go now and to discover, to learn more, to do more innovation that can then in turn benefit the planet Earth.
Absolutely. And as you said, it's definitely the ultimate adventure that you could take upon. But then how did you decide to buy that first ticket to space? And how does one buy a ticket to space anyway?
Yeah, I bought my first ticket to space in 2000. So I was very early bird in that regard. And it really came about, I was as an adventurer, I'm well connected into the adventure world. And I was exchanging ideas about new adventures with other people. And one person one day said to me, "Have you heard, Per? It's actually possible to go into space." And I was like, "Wow, really?" And within less than 48 hours, I figured out who to get in contact with, spoken to them, and effectively signed up for private space. And then I started the same year in 2000 with my first space training, which was done on some of the Russian facilities in Star City, where the cosmonauts would be training. In fact, we were training side by side with them. It was also where Yuri Gagarin was training, the very first person in space. So it was quite frontierish at that time. I did my centrifuge training. I flew Russian MiGs, fighter jets, and we did weightlessness training in these big Ilyushin 76 cargo planes. So it was very exciting, and that's where it started. But it was literally because I was talking to one of my fellow adventurers, and he said, "Space is opening up," and that was it. So I wrote a check and thought not much of it. It was only later I was to discover what the whole thing entailed, but a good start to it.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like a good start. But in the book, you share that so far you've bought 3 tickets to space in total. So how come you had to buy 2 more tickets after the initial first one?
Yeah, because I bought the first. Once I bought the first ticket into space, first and foremost, whenever there was a new space rocket provider that came along, they would have heard about me because I was getting quite well known within the space community. So they would always reach out to me and said, you know, for instance, when Galactic launched in around 2004, I was contacted by the people from there, and they literally said, you know, they invited me to have a drink, and I said, sure, happy to have a drink. And then they offered me to become a founding astronaut with Galactic, which I accepted subsequently. And then later on, I was also contacted by X-Corps Aerospace to become their number one astronaut, which again also I accepted. And I felt like I'd better hedge all my bets. So whatever rocket is likely to go, I'll buy a ticket on it, because at that point we didn't know which ones were going to fly. And I guess in retrospect, that was a wise strategy, because you know, some of them ended up not flying. The very first one I bought ended up not going at all. X-Corps ended up going bust. So net-net, I face myself today with one ticket left, but it looks like that one is finally going, and I'm able to cash that one in, which is delightful. So it has certainly been an interesting journey with ups and downs and challenges over the years. But I am pleased to see that there a lot more capital is going into the private space arena at the moment, and a lot more action is happening, because that was a problem for the first 15 years, from 2000 to 2015 or so. The sector was really starved of cash and capital, and primarily due to the fact that you know, it's a risky business, and few people wanted to take the equity risk there in that regard.
Absolutely. But it seemed like the third ticket is going to be the lucky one for you, hopefully. All right. And then the introduction of the book, you tell the story of your training fight with MIG-25, which you mentioned a few minutes ago. So could you tell us more about that and your overall space training? How do you train to go to space?
Yeah, two key components of a space training is number one, getting your body used to taking these big G forces that your body gets exposed to when you're going into space. And secondly, making sure that you're used to being in a weightless environment, because that's not normal, floating around, etc. And in fact, up to a quarter of all astronauts going into space tend to get some sort of nausea or get a bit sick when they go up. So it's a good thing to train that as much as possible. I've done that primarily through three different ways. Number one, I've flown MiG fighter jets and other fighter jets, L-39s, where you go up to a certain altitude and then you twist and turn the jet around, and therefore G-forces are applied, a bit like you see in the Top Gun Maverick movie, where heavy G-forces are applied, and therefore your body gets used to heavy G-load. We have to, as future astronauts, we have to be able to take 3GZ and 6GX. So 3Gs pulling blood out of your head. At the same time, you have the equivalent of having six people standing on top of you if you were to lay down on the floor. So six people standing on top of your chest. That's sort of the force of gravity that one will experience. And you can very, very well train that through flying fighter jets. The second training element consists of centrifuge training. If you've seen Moonraker, James Bond, and seen how he gets thrown around in Moonraker, we use some bigger centrifuges that are much more powerful, and that's a very good simulation on the G-force application on your body, and therefore it's a great way to prepare yourself for space. And finally, when it comes to the weightlessness, I've flown weightlessness in a Ilyushin 76 in Russia, in an Airbus in France, and in a Boeing 727 in America. And what happens with each one of these, they go up to a certain altitude, typically 14, 16 kilometers, and then they nosedive down for 20, 30 seconds at a time, and then turn around, go back up again, back down again, back up again. And when they go down, they would be accelerating at a pace of G. So it becomes plus G minus G equal zero G, i.e. weightlessness. So one is floating around during those 20, 30 seconds in complete weightlessness, as if you were in space. So it's a very realistic simulation of going into space. and therefore it allows the body and the mind to be used to being in that particular environment. And I highly recommend it, even as a standalone experience. It's fabulous, and people listening to this podcast can indeed sign up directly and do that as a single experience in its own right. It's really tons of fun.
Yeah, that definitely sounds very exciting, but also it seems like the training is also very intense, which of course, yeah, probably should be like that. But then, do you know when you'll be going to space? Has that been scheduled already?
Yeah, the latest statement from Galactic is that they're going to start commercial operations in Q2 this year, and then they're going to take them one by one. So I would estimate that I'm going to fly probably within 12 months from there. We're waiting. We haven't set a date just yet, and it obviously depends on whether the first launches are going to be successful, which we hope. But I would say within a 12-month period from there would be that. So probably early part of next year.
Well, that sounds very exciting. Then it's going to happen soon, it seems. All right. But then, of course, people can read more about your space training and the tickets that you bought into space in your book. So now I just want to speak about one of the other adventures that you did. You actually mentioned that already during our talk, your skydive over Everest. So could you tell us how you decided to do that and how it went?
Yeah, the motivation for it was that my trip to space was getting delayed. So there was a bit of a gap in my adventure calendar. And so we looked into doing something with Everest. Everest has this kind of magnetic element to it, where as an adventurer, you want to do something with that mountain. So the first thing we looked into was, like many other people, climbing it. And whilst I have a lot of respect for adventurers who are doing that, it turns out that there's actually so many people who are doing it. It's becoming a little bit more common these days. In fact, it's becoming so common that in some places you have to stand in a line as you get closer up to the top. Which not only is dangerous, but it's also, it's difficult to do a world record when everybody else is doing it. So we sat down and thought about it and then decided, well, if it's too dangerous and too common to do it, sort of take Everest bottom up, why don't we think about it doing it top down? And it turned out nobody had ever skydived Mount Everest. So there was a world's first available. And arguably, since nobody else had done it, I mean, there was obviously a very good track record for safety purposes because nobody had failed. But we still figured that it would be less dangerous to skydive it because you will always get down as opposed to climb it. So that's what we decided. So we put a big adventure together, trucked half a ton of equipment up to our drop zone, which was close to Namji Bazaar, created our own landing strip there, which was no small feat. And then flew in a Pilatus Porter plane from Switzerland, took 5 days to get it to Nepal, and then had the pilot sit special training for Nepalese mountains and the Himalayas, which delayed us quite considerably, actually. And the weather then ended up being very bad afterwards. So it really ended up delaying us quite a bit. We also had to get permits from 7 different Nepalese ministries, which was not easy at all. So it was definitely a very difficult adventure to execute. But fast forward to October 6, 2008, together with Ralph Mitchell, I became the first person to successfully tandem skydive Mount Everest. And it was a great delight. It was obviously an amazing view. You can imagine coming down at 170 kilometers terminal velocity, looking at all the tallest peaks in the world, or a lot of the tallest peaks in the world, certainly Mount Everest, Dublin, and a few others. And it was just such a gorgeous, beautiful sight. It was cold. It was minus 50 degrees centigrade, so it was very chilly. And we free fell for about 60 seconds before we opened the canopy and then tried to find our way back to the drop zone, which wasn't easy. But we succeeded, and it was with great delight. We landed safely on the drop zone, and history was made.
Yeah, history was absolutely made, as you said, because it was a record-breaking skydive, and it sounds like an amazing adventure. So of course people can read about that story even in more depth in the book, but it's a very interesting part of the book, absolutely. And then my very last question to you is, because as you mentioned, The Sky is No Limit is just the first volume of your autobiography, and then the second one is going to be called Above the Sky. But what can you expect to read about in that second volume?
Yeah, we realized as we were writing the autobiography that one volume was simply going to be insufficient because my life has been very rich and full of experiences, and I feel like I've lived three lives effectively. So there will be a lot of exciting things. So that's why we had to chop it off into two. In terms of the second book above the sky, that's going to be a lot more about my later professional career, what happened when the world of finance, as I set up the way my family office and expanded my sort of business side of things, as well as also gotten into other exciting adventures. Like for instance, last year I was lucky enough to fly in on a C2 Greyhound and land on an US aircraft carrier and experience sort of a real Top Gun experience on there. There will also be some stuff from further space training, more zero G flights. For instance, in December last year, I was flying a zero G flight with Apollo 16 Charlie Duke, which was fabulous. There will also be some good pieces of advice for other adventurers and other entrepreneurs, how to successfully execute on their missions. And there'll be stories from, for those who care about that, interaction with lots of household names, A-list of celebrities, both from Hollywood and the music world and the world of entrepreneurs, a number of billionaires that I've come across over the years and some of whom are my friends. So there's a whole host of very exciting things also on the social scene. So it's really been a fantastic cocktail of adventure, preparation for space, fellow astronauts, exciting spinning training and great social events with household names and an interesting entrepreneurial journey. So there's something in there for everybody.
Yeah, it seems like there will be many more interesting and exciting stories and adventures that you're going to share in Above the Sky. So we are, of course, looking forward to that as well. But thank you very much, Per, for sharing your amazing stories and adventures with us today. Of course, our listeners can read even more in your book, The Sky is No Limit. But thank you very much for your time today.
You're welcome. Ad Astra. See you in space.
Yes, see you in space. Thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks everyone for listening. Don't forget to keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and at Lit Business Media on LinkedIn for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. We are now also on TikTok, so make sure you follow us at Lit Publishing. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.